Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Be Unique Unscripted, because an authentic life is unscripted. Presented by Bronner House Museum, Elisa Kaler, the spiritual therapist, and Little Green Oasis. Unscripted brings you amazing guests and open mic nights every Thursday night at 9 o'clock Eastern Time. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an opportunity to learn more. Visit our calendar on beunique.org to see who we have scheduled to appear next. That's beunique.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am delighted to introduce you to my friend, Alton Williams. I've known Alton almost as long as I've known Be Unique. He's been one of our greatest fans, ardent admirers, firm supporters, but Alton is a historian, a philanthropist, an author, and a storyteller. And I'm going to let him take the show away and talk about what he did last night, because I am so impressed. Alton, how are you doing?
Okay. I'm fine. And just how are you, Mary, this evening?
Other than a little tickle in my throat, I'm great.
Okay. And how's everybody else out there in podcast land?
Everybody's
here this evening.
Yeah.
Great. It's great to be here this evening. And I had a fabulous presentation over at the Seminole County Historic Museum Auditorium, talking about how history can easily be lost through education, racism, intimidation. Great talk, got great response, and it was just fabulous. And
awesome.
I am so honored. So, yes. If anybody got any questions for me, that would be great. Or I can continue to talk if you have any.
You keep talking. I'll let you know if we.
Okay. All right.
If we get any callers, let me leave our number. Oh, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
The number to call, if you have questions, is 516-418-5651.
Thank you so much for that. So, it is so easy to get lost. I've been operating the Evergreen Cemetery since 1998, and this is a cemetery that was donated by slave owners back in 1890, and it was an urgent thing for me to come to this cemetery because it was deemed abandoned and neglected, and it was on this task force list. This task force was created by the Agriculture Department through the state of Florida because there were so many complaints about abandoned and neglected cemetery and the eyesores that they presented. And why, of course, they were mostly African-American cemeteries with this, so people complained. But the whole underlying thing of it was about taking away land. And most people don't know that these cemetery properties that's been sit dormant and forgotten about, such as the one that I took over, which used to be called the Altamont Colored Cemetery, the Fern Park Cemetery, the Altamont and Fern Park Cemetery, the Altamont Community Cemetery. So it had quite a few different names, but the original name that it was supposed to be was Evergreen Cemetery, which was the name that it was supposed to be when William and Laura Bronner purchased the land and donated it for their servant/slaves. So it's been an amazing journey, and the journey continues. But it's been an amazing journey. I feel honored to even be able to do this job, you know, because it takes a special person to do this type of work, especially if you're donating your time. A lot of people wouldn't do that. So I feel honored to do that, you know, work in this cemetery. So this land was donated. So it was about to be taken over by a certain cemetery, a certain funeral home company or whatever. But it was just like the dead was speaking to me. And when I say that, most of the people that are resting in this cemetery, I grew up knowing. They were my elders. Or even some of the people, I grew up with my age and less my age are buried there. So I feel like it's my duty to take care of these people until one day when I lay to rest.
Cemetery. And you do a remarkable.
Yes, yes.
I said I've been to the cemetery, and you do a remarkable job with the upkeep.
Thank you.
Who helps you with that?
Well, it's just a board of two, myself and Cor J. Sneed, who's another dedicated board member, and she has a little history there at the cemetery as well. Her grandfather was one of the first trustees right after the slavery. Slaves owners moved to the side, and of course he was an emancipated slave. So he was born in 1858 and slave and emancipated, and his wife and brother were the first Caucasians to be buried in a predominantly black cemetery that's designated only for blacks, because black and whites were not allowed to be buried together. So I look at it this way, as I explained in my presentation to the Seminole County Historical Society quarterly meeting last night, God took something that was presented negatively to keep people apart because of the color of their skin and made it positive. So 60 years later, I came on to take care of this place, and look at all the positive things that are happening.
Oh my gosh, yes.
We have a great brand. We're building a beautiful museum in the cemetery. I met the granddaughter of the slave owners that donated the cemetery expecting something different, but needless to say, it was a gift that I got from these people from back in the day. So this is a great ride, and I'm enjoying giving back and paying it forward. I am. I really am. So it's an honor to take care of the community, and the cemetery is part of the community.
It is, absolutely. It's our final resting place.
It is. And if we're going to be in a final resting place, we want it to look nice, decent, serene, beautiful, inviting.
We want our family and loved ones to come and visit us there.
Absolutely. We don't want them walking through sand spurs and junk and paper and trash and stuff like that. So we want to honor them all the way to the end until we meet our Savior.
So, amen.
Yes, I'm excited. I'm excited about the whole thing.
You said you found the cemetery in 1988?
I was asked to come to the cemetery in 1998.
98.
Yes, that's when they was getting this information, and Mr. Ziegler, who was the chairman at the time, or trustee at the time, you know, failing health, an older man, and they asked me to come to help them out, and I just went there for a short stay. I was just going there to help them get their paperwork together, you know, to make it so it couldn't be taken over. But lo and behold, 21 years later, I am still there. And I wouldn't have it any other way. You know, I enjoy doing what I do, so We were able to get it and organize it and get it together. And it's been a journey because there was a lot of roadblocks in the beginning in 98. We had roadblocks with the city that the cemetery in, which is the city of Castleberry. We had roadblocks, to my surprise, with the people that live in my community, the host community, meaning it was very negative. We had negative stuff coming from the community where I live, negative stuff coming from the city trying to block this information and this history. And but we prevailed and broke through, and right now we have a jewel out there, and it's nice and shining right now, and we're going to continue to polish it and to make the brand even greater.
How many acres is the cemetery?
The cemetery originally was supposed to be 16 acres, okay? Right now it is 12 and a half acres, and the reason it's 12 and a half acres, back in the 40s, somehow some of the land got deeded away. And that's another way how history got lost, education. So this is my opinion, and from me, not only my opinion, but me looking through the records and letters and things from this family, the Brunner family, these people, when they sign things, Mary, they would say their mark, or they would make their mark an X. Like that,
I've seen that on old TV shows, Make Your Mark. And you just put an X there.
And it's a reality. It's real.
And your ex could look just like my ex. Or I could, somebody who wants whatever it is you've got or I've got can come back and say, right here, there's her ex. She made her mark.
Right.
What am I supposed to do? Yeah.
Right. And when they make their mark, they conveniently have a witness, which would be on their side. So it was easy. It's easy to take something from somebody that don't have the knowledge and the wherewithal to fight something like that because they don't know. And I'm making that back in slavery because back in the day, blacks, because this is a predominantly black cemetery and it was run by predominantly black people except for the one person, which was Mr. W.E. Merritt, which he was W.E. Green. But his family ostracized him, kicked him out because his sister married a black emancipated slave, and he was very positive about it, so they kicked him out too. And a matter of fact, W.E. Merritt, which used to be Green, changed his name to Merritt because of that. He was the first white man to ever be buried in our cemetery, and he was the only white person besides the slave owners and one other gentleman that was on our board of directors and trustees of the cemetery. So it's an amazing story.
How many people are buried there that you know of?
Right now, from the documentation I had, almost 1,000, but I'm sure there's more. Oh. And we're steadily finding people and stuff is coming up. So the research is continuing. After 21 years, we're still – go ahead.
How do you find an abandoned grave?
Well –
you don't go with shovels and start digging around, I'm sure.
When we first came to the cemetery, we have a magnetometer, which it bounces off to whatever's under the ground. Now, a magnetometer, everybody think is so efficient, you're going to find every bone, everything, but that's not so. Now, we thank God for the city of Alamo Springs that came out and you magnetometer the entire cemetery, and we found some graves like that. The ones in the vault are those ones that maybe have been in a casket, but that's not always the truth. And that's why I say that piece of property, we going through the land that was supposed to be, it's the cemetery, 16 acres, its original size. We won back a half an acre of it, which left, it was a 5.27 acres, and we in court won a half an acre back. So we felt that on the piece we didn't get back, that's where the slaves was first being buried. So, and those other owners thought, you know, we magnetized them, we didn't find nobody. But you cannot always find somebody how they used to bury wrapped in a sheet and just putting the body in the ground. That magnetometer can't bounce off of something that's not basically all one thing. So
right now
you ask the question, you just can't find a body just to be digging them up. Well, we are a still active cemetery. So sometimes when we're digging, we have what you call it, that's a probe, a metal rod. And what I do is when I get ready to install, or we talk to a family member and they pick out a grave space, which, by the way, we don't charge for grave spaces. You just give a donation, and
we don't
tell you what to give. So it's, you know, it's basically whatever you say, and you get the grave space. You know,
very generous.
That's why I say something was negative is made positive. So getting back to, you know, do you find graves? So sometimes when we're digging graves, we can see evidence of a grave that was there. So once we see evidence of a grave that was there, and that's the only way you can find when you're digging maybe another grave to inter someone. So yes, we do dig. And yes, over the years, I'm finding one and two graves from, it's not like we're digging to dig up someone, but when we're digging to install or inter someone in the cemetery, and you see signs, oh, this may be a grave here. We cover, mark it, and catalog it, and move on to the next part, because the cemetery is 128 years old, so it could very easily, we can very easily unearth people by mistake or while you're doing something. So yes, we'll continue to find graves, and we just catalog them and mark them and put them in our records thing, and we put what you call an unknown marker. That means you say there's a grave here, but we just don't know who it is in the grave. So yes, that's how we continue to find people. And right now, we're looking like 1,000 from our records, over a little bit over 1,000 people that are in the cemetery. But our cemetery break down the spaces. We got probably over 3,000 spaces left for people to be buried there.
Now you mentioned early that this was originally a cemetery for the Bronner's slaves.
Right.
So
the Bronner slaves and any other started out with William and Laura Bronner, because there's once their servants/slaves begin to die, the law was you don't bury them together. You know, they separated them just like in life. In death, they did the same thing. And that's what makes the cemetery historical, because they did it because of the skin color of people. So that's why we're a historical cemetery. So, yeah.
That's amazing.
Only for black people. So the cemetery is predominantly African American.
And
it's predominantly black, but go ahead.
Because of the social climate of the time, I can't imagine that these families were given the pomp and circumstances that we've come to experience and expect at a funeral. They may have not been, may have been in a pine box, or may not have been, right?
That's correct. They would sometimes, and it really wasn't a tradition, they did the best they could do. Sometimes they wrapped them in sheets and lured them down to the grave, a box, or nothing at all. And who's to say when a slave, not only the Bronner slave, but just black people, period, who's to say how they was treated, you know?
Well, we know they weren't treated very kindly in life.
No.
So I can't imagine that they were treated much kinder in death.
Right.
I'm so grateful.
I agree with you there.
I'm so grateful, Alton, that you've come along and you started to unsterilize this history. Now, you've written a book called Ann Pines, History in a Shoebox. I would love to know First of all, how are your sales coming? You've been...
the sales has been tremendous. We're almost up to $1,000 now, almost. And they're tremendous, and we're getting interest from all over the place. We're now getting... Museums are now buying our books to go in their museum to sell them. And I made
Excellent.
Them affordable for the museums by so they can make money and operate, you know, to earn something to benefit their museums. So it's
yeah.
been great. I mean, I'm self-published. I'm not on Amazon or any of that type of thing, but they're going good. And it's a slow process, Mary, but I keep grinding and grinding. And the book's been out for a while. I don't think it's been a year yet, but it's getting traction, and it's doing the book sales are doing great. I think if I got close to say 600-700 books sold, that's not too shabby.
Not bad at all.
No.
So
we're getting close to that.
What can people learn by buying one of your books?
They can learn how history can be lost. And then it'll also teach them how to preserve history and not to put their history in a shoebox and get lost. Ergo, when you said Sand Pines History in a Shoebox, the reason that title is because back in the day, the neighbors and out of the host community would get their rakes, shovels, and hoes, and to keep the cemetery clean, they would go over and clean it and everything, and at the end of the day, it would be around, like, you know, Christmas time, be some end of the year where they would go over and, like, spring clean the cemetery.
Yeah,
and
my grandparents did that.
Right. After they finished cleaning the cemetery, they would take home a sand pine for their Christmas tree. And that's why the sand pines come in. And then they would take that home. And then we also would share to make money to keep the cemetery up to get some kind of income. We would go to Sanford, to Goldsboro, and sell trees and stuff like that to get income for the cemetery. Now,
uh-huh.
where the shoebox part of the name come in to the book is, when I first was asked to come and to serve on this board or as a trustee, I went to the chairman's house and I asked him, I asked Mr. Ziegler, I would need all the records, you know, for the cemeteries because we was trying to get it straight and, you know, trying to get it incorporated to get the
right.
file, you know, make it legitimate to make it so we can make it work. And he said, okay, I can get the records for you, but they're under my bed and they're in a shoebox. Strange
oh
as it was, I say. So strange as it was, Mr. Ziegler went into his bed, in his bedroom, and under the bed, he came out and brought out these records that was inside this shoebox. Okay. Little small shoebox. And the records were kept oddly. You know, they would be on the back of grocery receipts, old brown grocery bags where they tore the bags in little strips and would write the name of the people that was buried and where they were buried in the cemetery.
Oh, my goodness.
And,
no
yeah,
no
and
journal or record keeping,
no,
actually.
No journal, no spreadsheet or anything like that. That's how they kept the records. So all these records was inside the shoebox along with another small, like a little receipt book, and then it was about $500. So they had trust issues. So they didn't trust anybody, didn't use bank or anything at the time. And, you know, being black or brown, you did what you needed to do to survive. So
yeah.
That's how they did record keeping. So
that's crazy.
That is how the title of the book became Sand Pines, History in a Shoebox. Those two things, those sand pine trees and that shoebox, is where we got started. And that was one of the most positive things about the cemetery in the beginning, because it being donated for slaves and separating blacks from white, that was a negative part. But that shoebox and those sand pines were positive things, because those sand pines were given to people after they did something good for the cemetery by cleaning it. Or it was something good when we was able to sell and make money to upkeep the cemetery. You know, and the shoebox was the safe, or the key box, or whatever I would say, where we kept the papers and stuff in a safe place, which is all of that was positive.
Well, I can tell you that nobody would think to look under someone's bed for money in a shoebox.
No, or even records.
Man, that's wild.
It's wild, but it's true. And here we are 128 years later. I mean, if people really want to take a look, they can go on evergreencemetery.us. That's our website, and see pictures. Or they can physically visit the cemetery at 150 South Cypress Way, Castleberry, Florida, 32707, and visit the cemetery. We do have a walk-in gate that's open 24 hours a day. Or they can call our message line, which is 407-374-7149, and we can give them information, or they can leave a message, and I can return the call like that. So we would love for people to come. And by the way, about the book, I will be announcing in the next couple of weeks or so about a book signing. I think we have enough books out there now. It's time to do a book signing. So I hope everyone that purchased books saved their books and got them in good condition so I can sign them.
I've got mine.
That's great. So I'm looking forward to that. Yes.
Now, where were you? Where were you speaking yesterday?
I was speaking at the Seminole County Historical Museum in Sanford, in their auditorium. And I was speaking at their quarterly meeting that they have quarterly for their historical board, you know, their historical society board. They have their meetings, and they have speakers there. I was asked to do this a year ago, so I've been on their schedule for a year, being with the COVID. They locked me in, and it was amazing. It was socially distanced. You know, they did what they needed to do so to make this work. So that's where I was at, and this was in Sanford, Florida. And you can go on to their website, and at you can like type in Seminole County Historical Museum, Sanford, Florida. It'll bring their page up, and you can see all the good works that they're doing there, and also see the video, that presentation that took place Tuesday night. But I do have a video come out. I just want to thank God for Jennifer East, who works with you at the Unique.
She's a delight.
That came out, and she did some recording, so we're putting together a presentation for YouTube and our Instagram page and our Facebook webpage that'll be coming out soon, and we'll be able to show a different side besides the live stream that was live streamed on Tuesday night.
Very nice.
Mm-hmm.
So was the room packed?
We had 17 people in the audience, which they told me that was good. It was allowed to be 25 people only because of the COVID, so we almost made it. And then at the time, there were 10 people online. We did get a few questions through Facebook. So I think that was significant and good. We got there, but after the fact, while people are going, they're visiting, I saw all the views and stuff, so it's still getting hits right now.
And it will continue to.
People are viewing and making comments. Yes.
Yeah.
People are making comments about and how pleased there's no negative comments, you know, so. It's great.
I can't imagine why anybody would feel the need to post a negative comment. You're doing a wonderful thing.
So.
That's good.
Right.
That's really good.
So that's what's going on our end at the museum, and we're excited and looking forward to the day that it opens. Like I said, we have so much stuff. We've gotten so many items and stuff until we did have to do a second phase onto the museum. So we're adding another 242 square foot on the museum. And our update is they're getting ready to put the floors down on the second phase and put up the walls. So we're moving pretty good. And I'm looking to open that thing sometime next year, in the middle of next year. So, you know.
Now, I'm curious.
We're keeping our fingers crossed.
What kind of floors are you putting down?
Well, we're doing the base floors, wooden floors, but we're doing this tile that looks like wood. And the reason we're doing that is because of the maintenance and upkeep of the place, so we can keep it clean. And, you know, we're not putting down really, but underneath that is wood.
Okay.
So on top of that is this tile, and it looks like wood. So we've got to do that.
My grandmother lived in a shotgun house. And they had something that I was told was called, I forgot the name of it. It looks like linoleum, but it was prior to linoleum. It rolled out in these long rolls, and then if it peeled up underneath, it was black, like tar paper.
Okay. I don't know. I haven't heard about, anything like that, but okay. But when I was growing up, it was all wooden floors. We would have to get down on our hands and knees and scrub those floors with that lye soap.
She had certain rooms. Yeah, there were certain rooms that had that linoleum type stuff, and then other rooms had the wood floor. And I can remember her scrubbing with lye. I remember watching her sweep the yard with a broom. She had a special broom that she made herself. And she used that broom to sweep the yard, and I was told that was to keep snakes away.
And we did that. We made the broom out of we call them dog feathers. Grew up outside. We was pretty poor. So you take them and then you tie it together, and we swept the floor with that. Also swept the yard. We didn't have a yard rake, and it done great. So, you know. So, part of
we called ours witches brooms.
Switch broom, that's right. It's the same thing. That is it. You are a country gal.
Oh man, you got no idea.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine.
I am green beans, not green beans, but black-eyed peas and cornbread through and through.
Okay now. Okay now. I love it.
Yes, sir. And you know what makes cornbread really good? Crunch up a little crackling in it.
Oh, the best. I remember when we were growing up and when we slaughtered a pig or whatever, you know, everybody did it at the same time.
Yep.
And we slaughtered a pig because there were certain people in the community that didn't have anything, and we would share the food with them. And I was discussing this in the presentation Tuesday night, and we would take the cracklings. You know, you take them and cook them right in the big black wash pot and drain the grease, and then that's where we take it and make that cornbread. Oh my Lord, so good. And we would have the crackling skin, eat them on the side, or you can add them in the cornbread and stuff. So you are amazing. That is amazing. Yes.
My uncle used to say He took everything from the pig but its squeal.
Yeah, you threw away nothing.
Nothing was ever wasted. And you're right. It'd be 40, 50, 60 people there. Sometimes, you know, I'll see my family, there were 8 children. So we were half of the population.
Right.
But everybody got food divided at the end of the day based on how much work you did, how early you showed up.
Right.
How long you stayed. Don't be showing up at my uncle's house at, you know, 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning, planning to leave by 1:30 or 2 and expect to carry home a tub of meat.
Right.
You might get a jar of lard, but that would be about it.
Yeah, right.
But
so it was
you were
tough
at
back
his
in the day,
side.
But
was,
we managed. You know, it was tough back in the day, but we managed. It was really good. Really, really good. So we managed.
And, you know, I think sometimes people who don't have that experience don't understand what real survival is.
Right. And they don't. I take right now, Mary, my experience back then, is working for me right now. And it's called, it's in survival, showing you how to survive.
Yeah.
So, yes. So I agree with you, everything. I agree with everything. So do we have any questions asked for callers yet or anything?
No okay. Callers. Let me throw out that phone number one more time. It's 516-418-5651. We're talking live on Thursday, August 19th, with historian, storyteller, author, philanthropist, Alton Williams.
Yes.
I think Alton's more than all of that. He's like the brother from another mother that I just discovered about 4 years ago. You and I have so much in common. We were both brought up by poor people. We were both brought up in large families.
Right.
We know what it's like to deal with adversity. I can remember asking my mother. Now, she was 2, I think, when the stock market fell right before the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember asking her something about being poor. And she said, Mary, we were all poor. Now, I know that my grandfather wasn't destitute poor. He did own property. He owned a logging outfit.
We all did. Even my parents had, I mean, back in the day, property, but you still was poor.
Yeah. Well, I can remember my mother used to tell us stories about how my grandfather would take the sides off of his logging truck and he would put sides on it, I think, at Saturday and Sunday, and he'd go through the neighbor, you know, they called it a neighborhood. His closest neighbor might have been 2 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
But he would drive through, pick up all the neighbors, they'd go to town, do their shopping. Then on Sunday, he'd drive them all to church. And she would always tell these little stories about this person or that person and her childhood memories of it, you know. And I said, Mama, they must have thought you and you know, your family was rich. Because I'm thinking, okay, well, they have no car, no truck. They relied on my father to be the taxi driver. And I asked her, did he charge them money? She said, no, he would never charge money. That would have been, you know, kind of against the purpose. So, you know, neighbors do what neighbors do, and you don't charge people to be a neighbor. And I said, well, he was the one with the wheels. Didn't they think that you were richer than him? And then they were. She said they were grateful to have an opportunity to go to town. We didn't look at it as you have more or I have less. We just pulled it together and did what we had to do.
Right. You lived your life. You did what you had to do to survive. And that's just how it is. It wasn't about impressing anybody. You was trying to survive, and you did what you needed to do. So I agree with you on all of that.
Yeah.
So I do. And that's where that goes around. That's why you have to tell these stories so that history don't get lost, because it easily can get lost. And when you got people trying to make you forget or trying to block you and block this history, and they really don't know why they're doing that, we have to keep telling our stories and, you know, tell what went on, tell all of this so we don't go back there and do it in a positive manner. And this story has to be told and put out there. So that's why I created Sandtown's History in the Shoebox, because that lay dormant 128 years. That story almost to get told. And it's so much is coming out of those few little pieces of paper that was inside that shoebox. What an amazing thing.
You're working on a second book, aren't you?
I am. I am working on a second book about the history of Altamont Springs. And I am working on, a second book, three books, to be honest with you. But this book I'm doing first about the city of Altamont Springs, Seminole County, and the black history, because there's none. It's amazing. I am a 62-year-old man, and how they wrote the history back in the day, Mary. And you could have, like right now, I could read in one of the history books in Altamont Springs, it'll say, wow, the colors are excited today, because I've read this in some of the minutes, what they had like in 1888 or 1890. It was the only little thing they would read is either something negative about the blacks or how the blacks ran through Mary Lou's kitchen and stole something and they hunted him down. Or the blacks was excited today because they built their first house in their community. Stuff like that. Nothing about the grocery stores, nothing about them being teachers and stuff what they did, positive stuff like that. So that's why other people can't tell your history when they didn't live it. And, you know, we live this history, so I'm honored to be able to write this next book, this first book about blacks in Altamont Springs, and it's called On the Other Side of the Tracks, History Through a Black Community Eyes.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm.
I know you opened my eyes with the story about Mr. Epps.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Amazing.
Will there be stories like that in this next book?
Yes, our next book, you had a lot of, you know, tragic things happen in the day. And that was something, I'll talk about the Ku Klux Klan, how they rode through the neighborhood and burned crosses. And, you know, I've collected all that stuff over the years that I've been, trying to get this book together. So I have pictures and I have oral, I have things that go all the way back to 1998. I have over 14 oral history that I recorded. So,
wow,
a big deal that's coming up. But
there's another similarity. My mother remembers as a child when she woke up in the middle of the night to a woman screaming, "Help us! Help us!" And the Klan was after a young woman, her husband, and their children. And my grandmother brought them in. It was in the pouring down rain. She brought them in, gave them towels and helped them dry off, gave them clean clothes, and said, "Here, you sleep by the fire all night. You don't leave until tomorrow morning."
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't, my mother said, they didn't discuss why were those men after you. Did you do something wrong or anything like that? It was just my grandmother knew they needed help, and they were being persecuted, and she wasn't going to stand for it.
Right.
So she woke She woke my grandfather up. She said, Steve, get your shotgun. If those men come here, I want you to shoot them.
Right.
Said, I will not put up with that in my house.
Right.
Of course,
wow.
I'm grateful that none of that had to come. You know, they just kept on riding past. But the times have changed, but not enough.
I was just going to say times have changed, but, you know, stuff kind of remained the same, if you ask me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been done in a more different and sophisticated way, but in an obvious way. So, yeah, times have changed, but not good enough. Because we want to be able to be in this country and live that dream where it says everybody's equal, everybody is, you know, have a right to live their life and feel that dream and stuff. So without any negative stuff, wow. But it's a lot to be done.
Yes. If there's any bright spot to anything, is today you can't hide your behavior. There's social media, there's technology. You know, back in the 1920s, when this was happening in my mother's neighborhood, nobody would know about it. The people didn't have telephones. And even if they had a car to drive somewhere, they probably didn't go 20, 30 more miles an hour. So it wasn't, nothing would be done quickly.
Right.
And now everything operates at the press of a button. So at least if something unpleasant's going on, you can get some kind of help.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I get that. And yeah. So I didn't mean to say that there's not positive things. There's not an antidote.
Oh, no, you didn't.
And there's an antidote for everything, because like you say, at a push of a button, you can get some attention in whatever is going on.
Well, what I would like to see is that we don't even have to push that button, that we never have to worry about people doing the wrong thing or people mistreating other people. That's my goal in life. If people if we could each one look at the next person with the eyes of kindness and recognize them as a fellow human traveler on this earth, we wouldn't have any problems.
Right.
Kindness is the way, but people don't want to bother with that, I guess. I don't know.
Well, people didn't always want to go that way. They don't want to go in kindness, in the kind way. So, yes. I hear you. I hear you on that. But if we, it's people like me and you, if we take care of our little corners, and then bring them all together, you know, I mean, the world, it'll get better. It'll come one
step at a time.
One step at a time. That's it.
Well, Alton, I can't think of anything else to ask. Have you got anything that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I do. I want to say to the listeners, be patient. Be steadfast. Know your history. Don't always listen to the negative part of something and keep it negative. If it's negative, you try to make a way to make it positive.
I like that.
So, you know, so we can live our lives and take care of your corner and share that with somebody, pass it forward. So that's what I would like to leave with the audience tonight.
Well, I think those are very wise words, and my ending show is always going to end on kindness, because I think no matter what you do, no matter where you go, you can always be kind.
Right.
And with that, Alton, thank you for joining us tonight. Our time is up. It has flown by, but that's not unusual when you and I get together.
Right.
We just start talking, and there you go.
There you go.
you know, I'll definitely have you back on when your next book is out or when this book goes into second printing.
Absolutely.
Or whatever your next milestone is, keep me posted. I know you will.
Oh, of course. I would dare not leave you out.
No, because if I find out through side effects, you and I gotta have some words, brother.
Thank you so much for that.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. Bye, everybody.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
If you like the show tonight, let us know. Call 321-417-4309 or email mary@beunique.org to ask how you can sponsor the show. It's simple and doesn't have to cost much at all. Visit beunique.org for even more details. That's BUNEKE.org. Join the global world changers who already know how Be Unique helps bring together like-minded humans who are making the world a better place. Read the magazine and blog posts, watch our videos, listen to our podcast, and visit our social media from one location, and let's work together. Change tomorrow by finding solutions today. Visit BeUnique.org to learn more. That's BUNEKE.org.